Step into modern luxury at Langham in Grandview. Your boutique, studio plus suite awaits with a premium kitchen, spa-inspired bathroom, and elevated finishes throughout. Just steps from your door, lounge poolside in a private cabana, unwind in the hydrotherapy spa, perfect your swing with virtual golf simulators, or visit the fitness center for a Peloton ride. Availability at Langham is limited. Reserve your studio plus suite today at livepreferred.com.
League's Cup returns to Columbus. Your reigning League's Cup champion Columbus Crew are hosting three matches at Lower.com Field. Come out and watch the Crew take on teams from Liga MX, Toluca, Puebla, and León starting July 29th. Grab your tickets now at ColumbusCrew.com and watch the best in North America battle to keep the trophy at home in Columbus. No ties, only wins. Major League Soccer versus Liga MX. League's Cup returns to Columbus, Ohio. Be there.
The Vox Markets Podcast. Nothing in this podcast is intended as investment advice, and the people in this podcast may hold positions in the stocks they talk about. Do not buy anything based solely on a tip or recommendation. Please do your own research.
Welcome back, everyone, to The Exchange Live. My name is Paul Hill. I'm delighted again to be able to speak to star fund manager Richard Penny of Crux Asset Management. So welcome, Richard.
Yeah, good morning. Thanks very much for the invite, Paul.
Yeah, well, it's great to have you on the show, particularly as we've got quite a lot of big macro data coming up over the next 24 hours. We've got the interest rate decision from the Federal Reserve and also its commentary. And then next at lunchtime tomorrow, we've got the Bank of England doing the same. But before we sort of like run through your view of the actual markets, I'd just like to say a big shout out to our sponsor today, who's keeps the lights on for us, which is Edison Research. They do sort of like excellent research and commentary on listed stocks, both here and the UK. And I've been using them for sort of like for 25 years. In fact, actually on their website at the moment, it's worth just checking it out. It's all free. So I'd strongly suggest that people have a look at it. But it's quite interesting. One of the comments or articles in December is talking about the M&A and activists at the gate, etc. But anyway, that's all free. I don't know if do you ever use Edison at all, Richard?
Yeah, we're big fans. We've been pleased to do meetings with them and do videos there. There's a lot of good analysts that have left the city, well, continued in the city at Edison, and just pretty independent stuff, and it's usually very in-depth and well-written.
Yeah, no, I would agree. Okay, good. Well, let's move on to sort of like, first of all, just a quick reminder of what kind of investor you are for the audience's benefit there. What kind of stocks do you like, Richard?
So I like growth stocks and I like to buy them cheap. So I'm a small and mid-cap investor. Been doing that for 33 years. My background originally was engineering and sort of technology, that kind of things. And we did very well buying some of those on a recovery basis in 2000. So predominantly what I try and do is use recessions to buy growth stocks at really interesting level entry points.
Yeah.
And actually, although the US is very expensive at the minute and it's quite a buoyant bullish market, the UK market is much cheaper, and the AIM stocks on the UK are really very cheap to go stock picking in.
Yeah. Well, you're quite modest, actually, because I was just looking at your long-term returns over 25 years, and you've absolutely annihilated all your indices. Obviously, that strategy's been doing well. How do you view the sort of climate at the moment? Because at major sort of dislocations, whether it was the pandemic or the great financial crisis, you seem to have really then sort of filled your boots, actually.
It's basically by often buying companies under 200 million, perhaps sort of slightly sub where the main institutional investors are, and finding them when they're very out of favor, possibly not doing so well, this kind of recovery bias. We have traditionally found stocks that go up 5 or 10 times just because they get oversold. Quite often you get large investors who fall out of love with a growth stock after a couple of downgrades, and that often can be a really good entry point. The problem, if there is one at all in small cap, is that everybody's been saying how cheap they have been for some time. But I think genuinely now there is a sense that 2025 will be quite a lot better.
Yeah. And what so in terms of sort of like how much better it will be next year, what's a sort of like the level of underperformance for sort of like just generally for small caps? Because that must be setting up a sort of like mean reversion trade, I guess.
Yeah, I mean, we have, there's a slide here, obviously. I mean, the UK is on a P of 10.5 as opposed to 26 for the US.
Mm.
And I think the 10.5, I'm not going to talk about the US particularly in its valuation, but the 10.5 sets you up for good performance potentially in the UK. That would, you know, for every £100 invested, that's kind of a 9.5% return if they convert it into cash. But there's sort of red outline there shows you that small caps, the AIM market is 59% down. You know, and that, the AIM market is where a lot of the interesting growth businesses that we look for tend to go. Mm. So, you know, healthcare and technology is where we look. And actually, although the 41% downturn since September 21 isn't worse than the GFC, the relative performance of AIM is huge. And at this point, we're not suggesting anybody buys an AIM basket or anything like that. But actually, if the average fall is 41% on AIM, there are some companies down a huge way that we think will be really good recovery stocks.
Yeah, good. Okay, just remind everybody, if you would like to ask Richard any questions, then please put them into the chat bot and I'll read them out. Let's move to one stock, the financials, that I know you quite like, is Distribution Finance Capital. That's DFCH. We don't talk about this a great deal. It's sort of like the specialist lending for sort of like agricultural equipment, motorhomes and you know, RVs and all this sort of stuff. How are you seeing this one going forward? Because it's trading at a huge discount, actually, to net asset value.
Yeah, well, you've got a good combination here because it's performing well. Last time I know and updated, there was an upgrade because the underlying business is performing strongly. I think the NAV is probably going to be about 60-odd p, 63p at the end of this year. The low point was 20p here. I think in reality, what happens is people would see this as secondary to, you know, the sort of Barclays and One Savings Bank, Barclays being a large bank, One Savings Bank being a mid-tier bank, and, you know, trading at a similar sort of discount. But when we do get some interest in the small caps,
yeah,
which we might be starting to see, then actually its return on capital and growth are a lot better. And its discount is about the same. So it's also a lot more transparent and sort of aligned to management. There is also a prospect they're talking about not only lending to the dealers, but lending to the people that buy the products. So they will finance things like Ducatis and pleasure boats and that kind of thing. They have a triple covenant. So although it might sound quite cyclical, they have a covenant off the dealers against the asset and against the manufacturers as well. So losses have been very good, even through the downturn. So what we would expect to happen, you know, shares at 35p, we'd expect good growth, continuing good trading, and for the gap to narrow. So you probably get, you know, it's not going to trade up to NAV, albeit that the shares, I think, were about 120, 130 when people were very excited about the growth 3 or 4 years ago. Mm. But, you know, it should post a return up towards 45, 50p over a year, we would hope.
Yeah, I mean, it makes net interest margins of about 7%, doesn't it? Which is obviously asset-backed and secured against the asset. It just seems as though it's a bit of a printing machine because can't have that much competition, I wouldn't have thought, if it make those kind of margins.
No, there's been very strong demand for the product as well. I mean, there's other people, if they had more capital, I'm sure there's other people that they would expand the business to. I think that the net NIM will come down towards 6% at some point because at some point, they'll have to put up the rates on deposits that they give to retail investors.
Yeah.
But that would still be very, very positive. And the loan book is growing very quickly, which is good.
Yeah. Another one which is in the financials, which is sort of quietly done well, is IG Group, which is the sort of like the poster child of all things spread betting and financial platforms and CFDs, etc. Big dividend payer, obviously. How are you seeing this one? I mean, we had I think was it CMC Markets doing really well this last year, also in the sector. How do you sort of like, you know, you view the IG going into 2025?
I mean, this is in some ways more of a steady one than a recovery stock, but you've got new management in here in terms of Breon Corcoran, who came in July and has updated people, been well received. You're right, free cash flow yield is pushing 10%, actual yield 5%, and we think shareholder returns will be the order of about 20% over the next 3 years. And Mr. Corcoran was at Betfair and Flutter and Paddy Power. And Betfair was one of the better stories in UK PLC over the last 20 years. So when you get the right person in with the right alignment, looking at something fresh, we think that'll be really quite helpful. And, you know, I think what we talk about the UK being at a PE of 10.5, I think when you look at a lot of the large companies, they are slower growth and, you know, people are a bit disappointed in them sometimes. I think the UK's market is cheap, but I think it's nice to find something that's cheap with a good yield, but with new management that can move it to another level.
Mm. Where will the growth go to? Where is sort of the new CEO saying? Is it international expansion, new products, or white labeling the technology to somebody else?
Well, his background's in fintech, and we don't know quite what he'd do next, but there's certainly financial flexibility to do that. There's a thing, business called Tasty Trade, where I think those trades get much higher multiples in the US, that there may be a disposal there or maybe a reinvigoration of that. But they were growing at 15%. And of course, one of the things about a stock like this in a portfolio is that because their clients tend to be long of the market, they tend to do better when the markets are volatile and even going down. So it's sort of additive to sort of quite high beta sort of stocks that we run elsewhere.
Yeah, it gives you that sort of like level of sort of downside protection, doesn't it? When the markets are going haywire and everybody's putting on trades, then IG does very well, makes hay while the sun shines, I guess. But a countercyclical play for a portfolio sort of management. Okay, let's move to sort of the healthcare sector. We've got a company that hasn't got a problem with growth is Creo Medical, which does sort of like specialist electrosurgical devices. I think it's sort of developed a pretty amazing sort of like set of devices that could do sort of like incisions and helps with lung cancer, basically removing cancers and all this sort of stuff. And also is inked to deal with Intuitive Surgical. How are you seeing this one? Because it's obviously got very high IPR, but still loss making.
Yeah, it is loss making. I think as a business, the jury might be out, but the price just looks a total anomaly. People were very excited about this stock 2 or 3 years ago. And like all technologies, we recognize this. Sometimes it takes longer and costs more. Mm. Now, they've said that they're selling a distribution business for a look-through value of about 70 million euros. And they've also raised 12 million pounds. And recently, the shares, the low point on your graph there, were trading way below that, which is effectively saying we're valuing the technology, at a negative value. And it's quite notable that late last week, I think the chief exec bought over 1 million shares at 13 or 14 pence. So bearing in mind that money was raised very, very recently from institutions at 24p, I mean, this looks like it's a trading buy up to 24p. It's a long-term buy because the technology is interesting. And when you sit and hear what the products do and you realize how sizable Intuitive Surgical is, there's no way this wouldn't be worth probably hundreds of millions to Intuitive. I think it's fair to say that in recent times, the level of sales of the novel devices, the first set was for lower abdominal surgery, has been quite slow into the NHS. But the next set of products, I think, will be for the lung and there'll be in robotic surgery. And that will be done by a bigger company. So we don't have the issues of a small company trying to sell things. And, if you're valuing the technology at zero, as I think we were, even at today's price, the scope for people to rediscover their excitement for the products.
Yeah, no, I would agree. I think it's it's fabulous technology, what they can do, particularly if you link it in with the Da Vinci machines, ultimately, that allow people then to do electrosurgical. You do a biopsy or you have a look at it using the robotics, then realizes the problem and get it all out at the same time, because that's particularly a major problem in lung cancer. That's no doubt about it, where you're sort of...
Yeah, they are pushing the envelope of what's possible. Pancreatic cancer as well, lungs. And the founder is a professor in North Wales, and he was at a business called Gyrus that was eventually sold to Olympus. A serial inventor of these sort of disruptive technologies. Mm. There's now commercial management in. Take time with these products because doctors for obvious reasons, are quite conservative. But it will be pushing on a much broader range of products going forward, and with the help of Intuitive Surgical, hopefully.
Yeah, no, I would agree. If anybody wants to have another good look at Creo, then I suggest that just go onto the Edison website, because they've actually got some pretty good research. I had a look at it myself, and they give you all the sort of the latest details about that particular business. Both a couple of analysts cover it, one from healthcare, and then there's an individual company analyst. But there's lots of reports on there that and details talking about how specialist and niche this this business is, and really it's patented and very unique. So it's all freely available there, guys. Okay, good. I've got a question coming in from let me just take this off. Got a question coming in from Andrew W. He's asking about Reynolds chains. Now, I don't know if you've ever had a look at this. I'm guessing probably not. It basically makes industrial chains. It's got a bit of a pension problem. But it's got a sort of overhang. But I don't know if you've ever had a look at this in the industrial side, Richard. No?
I haven't, but I'm hearing a lot of interest from brokers on it. They're quite keen, and it's one that we probably will look at in the next 6 months.
Yeah.
A lot of these small cap companies just appear to be very cheap, because they are very cheap, because there has been a weight of selling over the last 2-3 years.
Yeah.
Many of them are way too cheap. And of course, what's happening is we are seeing takeover bids to do, you know, it's when assets exist at the wrong price, they do have a habit of getting bought by private equity.
Yeah, no, I would agree. Okay, good. And the same sector, actually. I know you quite like Mincon, don't you? Which does sort of like rock mining in all kinds of different. So I think it's sort of for metals, maybe from gold or silver or copper or whatever it is. How do you see this one? It's sort of like it doesn't want me cover very much, but it's less than 12 times PE. So it's obviously, again, a specialist and very cheap.
It's a recovery stock. I mean, they do the hard rock consumables, as you say. They've got two disruptive technologies, one for tethering anchors for wind turbines off sea in deep water, and another for drilling hard rock, where they can reduce it's transformative in terms of the amount of energy and stuff it will use. Yeah. Interestingly enough, I mean, it's been cyclical.
Yeah.
Shares were up at a high of 130 when people were very excited about these two new products. They've had some issues. They had some issues with end market demand. But you can see there's a little blip down back there in July. Mm. Twice they've updated the market and said they're seeing a bit of a recovery. So, you know, the shares are trading near a 7-year low. There's definite recovery potential in the existing business. They are seeing some signs of pickup, and you know, it's a family-run business where, you know, they'll look after the assets properly. And there's these two disruptive technologies, one of which, I mean, if the wind turbine anchors work, I mean, they've said it could potentially double or even quadruple, I think I've heard them say, the business. You know, that's sort of slightly speculative, but you know, you're kind of getting that for nothing, because you know, you have this recovery ongoing and the shares are at a 7-year low. It seems anomalous that they wouldn't have recovered a bit, actually.
Yeah. How much of the revenues is consumable, sort of ongoing aftermarket sales, etc.? Is it relatively small, sort of 20%? I really don't know.
I think it's more than that. I mean, it's half of it's in mining. And then the rest is split between sort of water wells, which obviously got a growth angle, and construction. So they are seeing some recovery in the construction markets in the US.
Yeah, okay, good. Okay, well, let's go to a really popular share. It's in sort of like telemedicine. It's been a bit up. It's Cuth. They basically do mental health or digital health services. They're the number one by a long way in the UK for sort of like school children and, you know, young adults and stuff. When they branched out into the States about 3 or 4 years ago, won a big contract in California, which seems to be going okay. But, and then they also run another one in Pennsylvania, which now seems to be sort of winding down. How do you see this one going forward? Because obviously they've got something, but I guess the sort of question is, what is the durability of that US arm in terms of winning new business and extending the scope of existing contracts?
I think the durability is good. There's obviously a slight politicality about it, and sort of, you know, Democrats versus Republicans, even in the UK, you know, how you use and treat mental health. In the UK, I think it's a lot easier.
Yeah.
The Darcy report recently sort of said prevent rather than cure, use technology, and specifically mentions mental health. And, of course, Labour seem to be aligned to the Darcy report. So I think the UK may well be a bit better. This California contract, there was one versus hundreds of other people. Mm. The technology is good. Initially, I think genuinely the adoption was a little bit slow to start with.
Yeah.
And there's some worries about it becoming a political football along with other mental health products, not just Cuth. So there has been some uncertainty, but there's also been some factual incorrectness about things that have been written. So the reality is that the shares are now back to where the UK was pretty much valued without California. And I think the company are pretty confident that they should be winning other states. So there is, you know, a risk around California. Mm-hmm. So we believe that they would be compensated handsomely if California right. were to terminate, but we don't think that is the base case. And then the UK could be better. And there will be other US states, we think, if their management are correct. And usually, you know, these sort of contracts take months and months to negotiate. So management will have a pretty good confidence that they're progressing, you know, weeks before they would announce anything.
Yeah. Why is the adoption a bit slow? That's the sort of the crux of it. Because if it had been, you know, heavily used, I guess, by, you know, your target market in California and Pennsylvania, then I'm guessing then the contracts would have still been in place. They're sort of de-scoping it, I imagine.
People have to know that it exists and you can use it. So yeah. You don't just have to know it's there. And within the framework is budget to make awareness, to increase awareness. And the initial comment about usage when the thing had first launched, of course, in the first couple of months, the usage will be low. But wherever it is used, it's well received. There's scope to take this into other territories as well. But maybe the market just needs a bit of reassurance that, you know, another US state might be signed or something like that would certainly help it, perhaps.
Yeah. No, I mean, my wife, she used to work at a school and they were singing the praises of it. They think it's excellent technology. So it does what it says on the tin. There's no doubt about it. You're probably right. It just needs a bit more publicity and self-awareness and, you know, recognition in the relevant states. Okay, good. We've got a question, quick one. And I know you don't hold it, but Asib Ahmed is asking about Capita, which came out with a sort of like an Umar sort of trading update this week. I think they had a lot of cash coming out of the business. I think you did own it before, but I don't think you own it now. Any latest sort of views on Capita, the outsourcing business?
I think it's really pretty cheap. I mean, obsessing about quantity of revenue can be difficult, but it's about 2.3 billion of revenue. The management in there, very good. They were at SDR before.
Yeah.
I think everybody knew that the national insurance going up was going to be an issue for somebody with that much labour. I think there's about a 20 million hit from that, which we wouldn't have known about 3 months ago prior to the budget. But the level of savings here is about 140, and I think they're talking about getting up to 160 million, mm-hmm. which is significant for a company that's sort of less than 300 million market cap, I believe.
Yeah.
So, you know, Adolfo Hernandez, who's there, I think will have an effect. I suspect these are a strong long-term buy. I think the cash flow will really start to pick up in, you know, late 25 and 26. There are cash costs of taking costs out of the business. And even within the business, it's really worth looking at the central markets day because they've got a huge number of areas of business, but there will be some bits of it that are really far more valuable than others. So they've got quite an interesting pensions business, which I think has got a couple hundred million of turnover and makes 15 to 20 million a profit. You know, I don't think they have any intention of selling that, but that could be worth a lot of market cap. So we were slightly tactical in selling it, but I do think there's a lot of long-term value in this one. Very overlooked. And of course, it hasn't been a great story, but that's often the nature with recovery stocks.
Mm. Yeah, I mean, it's on a 5.2 times PE as I get it. So for next year, it's either the E's wrong or the valuation's wrong.
Yeah, and I think, you know, if they get anywhere near that, it would be a lot lower the year after because the cost savings do come through. Yeah. I think you have to believe that on the call center business they've got, that's quite big. AI isn't going to eat their lunch, but I don't think it will. I mean, they have the links with the customers and they're helping those customers to use AI in what they do.
Yeah. Good. Okay, well, let's on the other side of the Capita coin, we've also got a winner. We've got Advanced ADVT, which is run by sort of a rock star CEO, Vin Murray, in sort of like IT or software anyway. She sort of like buys software businesses, mission critical, as putting together a sort of like a portfolio. We've got lots of cash on the balance sheet and also, I think, a small stake, sort of 8 or 9% in MNC Saatchi as well. How are you seeing this one sort of develop? It's taken a bit of time, but the shares are now seeming to respond.
Yeah, I think she's well liked. She's done very well before at three businesses. She bought a business, funny enough, off Capita,
yeah,
a software business, has put the prices up. I think there's inbuilt momentum in the trading business that's there. There's still roughly about 100 million of cash and the M&C Saatchi shares where she should sell them to deploy.
Mm.
And she's, you know, very good at buying things cheaply and then improving them. But it does take time to affect that. So there may be some more bolt-ons. And then where you see the shares is a function of what you want to pay. I mean, the business is probably doing about 10 million of EBITDA run rate. Yeah. And it's, you know, probably that will go to 12 next year, maybe. And you'd value that somewhere between 10 and 15 times. So you've got 75p of cash, non-deployed. And it gets you somewhere between 150 and 190p with whether you want to pay 10 or 15 times EBITDA for that.
Yeah.
And, you know, at some point, there have been deals that were nearly done before. Where, you know, they've subsequently been sold for huge increases. So I think if there was to be an interesting acquisition found, there's just a chance that you might put 50p to a pound onto the share price if it's the right thing.
Yeah.
I think generally the price it's a little bit small for some of the institutional investors that have followed them before. I suspect there's quite a lot of people in the UK and the US that would really welcome it being a bit bigger. And, you know, the bigger it gets, the more investors it would kind of suck into the story and it would re-rate further. But with 100 million of cash, it doesn't need to raise money at this stage.
Hmm. Well, unless it does a huge transformational deal, rather than sort of like buying five small businesses from Capita, it decides to go up the value chain and tuck in a sort of software business, 100 million turnover, then it might need to. But that wouldn't be a daft thing to do, actually, if you've got the firepower and the shareholder commitment behind it.
Yeah, I think now there's a start and there's a trading business. It's quite a lot easier to tuck in bolt-on acquisitions.
Yeah.
And, you know, I'm sure, you know, the business is in competition with private equity who will pay far more and prove them less.
Yeah.
So that's been the difficulty, but just waiting for the right deal.
Yeah, no, you're right.
And significantly, I haven't mentioned this. I mean, Vin is a major shareholder. She's got 15 to 20 million quid in the stock. So
yeah,
she'll look after it.
Yeah, no, I mean, I've known her from sort of like commercial, from other companies and stuff like that. And yeah, I mean, she's sharp as a razor when it comes to negotiating good prices. And importantly, actually, will walk away if she's not happy with the price. So, you know, it isn't as though she gets sucked into things. Okay, we've got a question coming from Lemon Physical. Again, probably another company in your portfolio, Richard, is Gaming Realms, which does a sort of like a combination. It's mobile gaming software. It's sort of like major brand is called Slingo, which I think is a combination of a slots mobile game and a bingo mobile game. It's got quite a lot of growth. I don't know if you've ever seen this. I can't remember what the sort of the valuation is, but I think on a PEG ratio it's pretty cheap, actually.
Yeah, I think you probably answered that question better than I can answer. It's not one I know particularly well, but
yeah, okay.
Maybe we could look at it, but
Yeah.
There's just a lot of small businesses on AIM that are growing very well that look like they're the wrong price.
Yeah.
And you know, that's the opportunity at the minute, and we all want to know when they're going to improve, but hopefully they will do next year when the markets are hopefully a bit better.
Yeah, good. Okay, well, let's move to one of my favourite topics. We've got DP Poland, the old Domino's pizza, and everybody loves a good pizza at Christmas, no doubt about it. But it's gone through a good turnaround. I think the CEO has come from Domino's Pizza Australia and sort of hit the ground running about 2 years ago, taken cost out, expanded it, and just done basically all the basics perfectly. Anyway, it's had a huge benefit on like-for-like sales. I saw at the Q3 trading update, like-for-like sales, store sales, are up over 21%. So something's obviously going right. How do you see this one going, Richard, as everybody tucks in Poland and Croatia into pizzas?
Yeah, it's a good long-term story. I mean, it's not cheap on today's profits, but we've got good confidence that the revenues are growing, the profits will grow.
Yeah.
And Domino's has been one of the best models. The Australian business went up 75-fold. The UK has done over 100, and the US business did 100 as well. So we know that the franchising model works. Nils that runs it, he ran 10 of the 20 best sites in Australia.
Yeah.
I think he started when he was young and he owned 20 of them, bought the Croatian franchise. And he's a bit of a rock star on the whole Domino's community. And, you know, he's done a good job. The original business was struggling. But if you go and see the managers there, they're very enthused about the extent to which Nils knows what to do. And they're going to increasingly bring in franchisees, which is the right thing to do. And there is just a general drive to move up reduce delivery times, increase repeat orders. And there is some investment goes into that. But one might expect them to make acquisitions as well. They've raised some money to do that. And it's just a really good business model and a very, very competent manager. The turnaround's been done. I think probably most of the risk of turning around what was an underperforming Polish operation has been done. And then progressively they'll open new stores and they will probably perform way better and be much more ready to franchise.
Yeah, no, I would agree. And I think the long-term growth drivers. I mean, I think the population, I could be wrong here, of Poland is about similar to it is in the UK, sort of 50, 60 million, etc. And I think I looked at the sort of number of stores and I think they've got about 130 stores, whereas Domino's Pizza in the UK has got well over 1,000 stores, and I think it's trying to move up to 2,000 ultimately. So you can just see how, you know, if you've got 130 stores in a country that's not too far off the population of the UK, you've got a lot of potential, you know, new pizza buyers, I think, in Poland, certainly Domino's anyway.
Yeah, there's huge area to go. I mean, they think that they could get that ultimately towards 400.
Yeah.
And, you know, there may be opportunities in adjacent territories, Czech Republic or Hungary or somewhere like that.
Yeah, good. Okay, well, let's go up market. Let's go to another high-value company, Animal Care, in the animal side. Main business is in canine, sort of like painkillers, but has just bought an equine business out in Australia for about £60 million. So it's got lots of moving parts. How do you see this one sort of moving along in the next sort of 12 months or so?
Yeah, I think they've done difficult work here. Previously, Animal Care was put together by two acquisitions. And new management came into it, but there were issues fixing that 6 years ago. And recently they've sold a sort of dog tagging business. They got 20 odd million pounds plus in for that. And so they've just bought this business, as you say, for a good price, 9 to 10 times EBITDA, which is roughly what they trade on. And the management, the lady Jenny is in from AstraZeneca, I think is, you know, very good operator. The chairperson is from Dechra, which of course is one of the great success stories of the last 30 years. And, you know, veterinary medicines are for good reasons, very highly valued. So I think they've bought well. The shares trade at about 10 times EBITDA. They've got enough cash to make a couple more acquisitions without asking for more money. And at 10 times EBITDA, where they trade today, there's no reason why that shouldn't be up sort of 13, 14 times. Yeah. And we should get some growth as well. And plus these bolt-ons, you know, should drive you up through £3. May not be as spectacular as some of the recovery stocks, but it's a bit smaller, sort of sub 200, but it's exactly the characteristics that everybody likes. You know, the Dekra type pedigree, really good operating management. I think it'll get a really good following. And, you know, potentially now it's on the front foot, having been on the back foot for a few years.
Yeah. And I guess it's probably one of those companies that, you know, private equity, if they were going to do a roll-up or another sort of like animal drugs company decides to have a look at, ultimately, because there is quite a lot of, you know, consolidation in this. Another one I name potentially against, you know, having the slider all put over.
I'm sure that's what will happen, but I mean, I think they'll probably do a few smaller deals first. They're of a size where they can probably buy the 5 and 10 million revenue businesses.
Yeah.
Private equity probably wants bigger.
Yeah.
And the equine business that they bought, equine is quite a nice niche for them because it's not really a lot of competition from private equity in that area.
Yeah. Good. Okay, well, let's move sectors again. Well, this time slightly up, you know, up market. This one's a market cap of 2.8 billion euros. Is Zegona Communications, which is a sort of like, again, a well-respected management team that has bought out, raised funds and bought out the Vodafone Spanish division. I think it's got about 75% or so of it, and then Vodafone has got the rest. Anyway, it's going through that improved stage. The shares are improving as well in a, you know, highly competitive mobile sector. I know you talked about it positively, and you were right six, 9 months ago. How are you seeing it now?
So it's an evolving story. We've recently seen directors buying shares above today's level, which should give people confidence.
Yes.
And the share price is geared around about 3 billion of debt that the company has. So maybe not for widows and orphans, maybe obviously to put in a portfolio. But telecoms historically has been difficult because everybody spends the same amount of money, but they demand more, you know, in terms of bandwidth, speed and these kind of things. So it's been low return on capital. So Vodafone Spain was very heavily invested and probably slightly undermanaged, if we're being kind. Management's first job is to improve that, and I believe they're doing that.
Yeah.
The second job, which could be really interesting and is kind of the new, increasingly the norm in telecoms, is to find an infrastructure company that would perhaps buy out the network. Why that's interesting is because, you know, they bought this for about 4x EBITDA. Infrastructure companies trade on 15 and will pay 15 for assets. So there is a deal to do here where potentially, and they flagged this a year ago, they would take 2 billion to 3.5 billion in for those fiber assets. So this is kind of the income flow. If you pay £10 a month for your connection, somebody buys that off you and invests in the network going forward. So they would potentially lose 20% of their EBITDA, but get this sum of 2 to 3.5 billion in. But it's slightly better than that. It's because they would then lose about 100 to 150 million of costs against that 250 million. So net, they might lose 100 to 150 million, which is sort of 6 to 10% of their EBITDA, but get this 2 to 3.5 billion sum in. I think they would keep a stake. What we've seen progressing this year is verbal agreements to merge with Telefonica and Orange, who are the other players in Spain. And then, of course, if somebody buys the infrastructure, there's a shared network which can be invested in, and you're not tripling the investment, so everybody benefits. So we've seen a verbal agreement and legal agreements. We're also seeing speculation about 3 or 4 parties that would be interested. So these are kind of Canadian pension funds and, you know, Far Eastern sovereign wealth companies. And there's a lot of precedence for these kind of transactions. And where it gets even more interesting is that Vodafone, I think, owns 69% of the equity. Okay. Within the structure and the original buyout a year ago, there is scope to pay a special dividend and retire that 69% of the equity. So if they bought back the 69% at £1.50, then the 31% that we own as shareholders would then own the rest of the business. So it's not for those orphans. It's geared in all senses, financially and operationally. It's looking, they made really good progress.
So effectively, sorry, I got that totally wrong. So Zegona owns only 31% of Vodafone Spain and Vodafone owns 69%. Is that right?
No. Vodafone owns 69% of Zegona. Zegona owns 100% of
Vodafone. Oh, I see. Spain. Okay. That's what I thought. Okay. Yeah. Gotcha. Right. Yeah. Fine. Okay. Good. Okay, that clears that one up. I was a bit confused. Okay, let's come down the value chain, but in sort of stealth stains technology. We've got Madetech, which again is a sort of like a bit of a Marmite stock. It does IT sort of services, largely for the UK public sector. Shares have recovered after being totally battered, actually, over the last 2 years. And really sort of like, I guess the thesis depends on your view of public sector IT spend and whether these guys are going to be a winner going forward. How are you seeing it?
Yeah, I mean, you sort of summed it up. They floated at £1.30. Mm. You know, it was a real, well-respected business doing a lot in the public sector. They then had some growing pains, didn't make the profits they should have. There was a bit of a downturn in the public sector.
Yeah.
We've had a new finance director going in who's the kind of put expectations out there and beat them. And so the shares went from 130 down to a low of 9 pence. Mm. We've seen some positive trading subsequently. The fact that the election came early is good because that was always going to be an uncertainty. Just sort of around about that time, they won a couple of reasonable contracts, which basically means they have work whilst, you know, sort of Labour work out what they're going to do. But, you know, Labour have very much said that they will be spending money on digital transformation, which is exactly the sort of things that Madetech do. So it's about 0.7 times sales. You'd want margins to get up towards 10-15% EBIT margins. And, you know, they're probably fairly priced for the order book they've got at the minute. But, you know, one would totally expect that the shares would get more orders coming through. And that should drop through very nicely. So, you know, floated at 130, still only 23p, 0.7 times revenue. If people start to grow and love it, it's, you know, 1 to 1.5 times revenue potentially. And all it would take is 2 or 3 reasonable orders.
Yeah. What's the sort of the USP of it? Because obviously it's quite a highly competitive area. You've got public sector IT. I mean, you've got the big outsourcers. You've obviously got the even the consultants, the, you know, the EMYs and people like that. And then you've got all the Indian boys as well. It's sort of like a really sort of tough space to play in.
Well, it is, but then, you know, it's sort of large companies versus small companies. You know, government does support smaller businesses, and they do have specialities in digital transformation, you know, automating processes like driving licenses, these kind of things, which, of course, there is demand for.
Yeah. Okay, good. Let's gain switch sector. Stay in sort of technology, but it's been a bit of a, unfortunately, over the last 10 years, a bit of a widow maker is Xaar, which is sort of like the poster child of all things sort of digital printhead manufacturing. Had a big ceramics business, or still does to a certain extent, but I think that's sort of like now become quite commoditized and it's moved into printing colors and onto sort of fabrics and all kinds of things. How are you seeing this one? I mean, I guess, does it come down to sort of like USPs and competition and growth and stuff going forward?
Yeah, so this company can do things that the other digital printing companies can't, because it can print thicker liquids. That's why we did well in ceramics.
Yeah.
Ceramics back in 2008 was very transformative. People could print better tiles and took market share, and then the whole industry converted to it.
Yeah.
And, you know, prior to that, in 08, 09, we owned the shares and they were trading at sort of, you know, inventory plus cash because they were making no money.
Yeah.
And then it takes a couple of years for the products to come through. But those ceramics products probably came through way better than everybody expected. And they were making 45 million of EBITDA $135 million of turnover in 2013, I believe. Now, what has happened is that ceramics market has declined, largely, and sort of, if you want to be overly simplify it, because, you know, global tile demand is down 25% because they're not building a lot of apartments in China.
Yeah.
That will come back at some point. But what's also been happening over the last 5 or 6 years is they've built up 20 or 25 million of revenue away from that. They've got 20 new products coming out from their clients. Some of them are incredibly interesting and have the potential almost to be as big as ceramics, but you never quite know which ones will come off. But for instance, I think the most interesting one, arguably, is putting coatings on electric vehicle batteries. I mean, that's potentially a 500 million market. Yeah. They're in trial now. We wouldn't know for 6 months. But there's slightly niche markets like jewelry manufacture and printing on T-shirts and 3D printers that are quite interesting, where their technology is very relevant. The shares, I think in the next 6 months, or between 2 months ago and the next 6 months, we're going to have seen the bottom of this stock.
Yeah.
It's trading not far off the value of its inventory and its cash, about 8 million of cash. I don't think there's any financing problem. There's a scope. We know that they're launching these new products and that they can come through. You know, there's other things like printing stripes on cars and things, which could be huge. Making solder masks for electronics. There's a whole new range of other things. I think there's a trading update in January. I don't know exactly how they'll be trading, but yeah, probably ceramics continues to be weak. And it's going to be difficult, I guess. It's typical when the economy is a bit sluggish, which it is globally, to for these new products to come out. But we will see progress on the new products. And then we're trading pretty close to like lows and balance sheet value, even though the business is not making a lot of money. I think for a takeover, it'd be £1.50.
Yeah.
Could it go lower? Might do, but it's a really, really cyclical business because it makes the printer heads that go into cyclical industries. So, of course, if end demand goes down, nobody orders any equipment and they cannibalize what they've got, unless what they do disrupts an industry. And there is the potential for that.
Yeah. Yeah, I was looking at the actual margins, and given it's a high value proposition with unique sort of like, you know, properties that it can sell to customers and is disruptive, the sort of like the EBIT margins are for next year are less than 4%. And you just look at it and that's wrong. I mean, again, that's a cyclical low, isn't it? It should be a lot higher than that.
Yeah, it's operational gearing. It's if you go there, it's like a semiconductor plant. It's there's at least 40% drop through on revenues.
Yeah, okay.
And of course, we've seen revenue dropping off from ceramics and revenue coming in from the other areas, which has been about a draw. But at some point, ceramics doesn't decline, might turn around at the end of 2026 or something, and the other areas will potentially kick on with these coating batteries for electric vehicles. I mean, could be huge. I mean, people were very excited about it a year ago. It's not trading brilliantly, of course, but it's fairly close to, as I say, the scrap value. So if you can buy a business for its level of inventory and its cash, well, I mean, that would be 50p. It's a bit lower than here. But pay nothing for the IP and the 80 million they've spent on the equipment, which I think is depreciating about 16 million. You know, it's just a tactic. We know their long shares are long-term cheap. It's a high conviction long-term buy.
Yeah.
But you can see how it could go lower when the update's on trading. But I think everybody's aligned to do the same sort of thing. It's probably buy on the next trading statement, whether it's either good or less good, which we don't know, frankly.
Yeah, yeah. Well, at least one thing, I suppose, on the industrial side, we are seeing some green shoots. We come to another stock now, Vitrex, which is, again, in the industrial space. Does Peak Polymer, it's a bit of an expert in that, supplying sort of composites into the aerospace and EV markets and industrial applications, but also a very high margin usage applications into medical to spines and to sort of like ankles and, you know, basically other products, etc. It's got this peak knee, which is an knee joint that's hopefully coming through. Anyway, it came out with the trading update and the shares have responded reasonably well. How are you seeing this one? Because it's obviously, hopefully, it is cyclical, but showing that we are seeing green shoots in this sort of like a turnaround.
Yeah, it's the shares have come down from about 25, 26 quid, I think, in the long term. They hit about £8.60, I think, at the lows, and have bounced to £11.60. Yeah. Trading statement here wasn't particularly brilliant. It just wasn't getting any worse. And this kind of demonstrates what can happen. You know, this is like quite a lot bigger than something like Czar and the Mincom, but it kind of shows what can happen when things turn. It's suddenly there's no sellers and, you know, people want to buy the shares. They've still got a long way to go.
Yeah.
There has been significant destocking after COVID. Everybody was overly full of products because they couldn't get access to it. And so when demand turned down, people were emptying their store cupboards and weren't placing orders for these kind of products. They've also seen that in the medical area. But if you look on the website, you'll see they're developing lots of new applications, which, you know, for instance, the amount on an electric vehicle or an aeroplane could increase quite significantly. And again, it's very high drop-through margins. And then, I mean, this is one of the things that happens with companies that are nicely cash generative and a high return on capital. In a downturn, when you lose a pound of revenue, you lose a lot of profit from it, which basically means that if you time it somewhere close to right on the upswing, when things do pick up a bit or stop getting worse, you not only get some revenue growth, but you get disproportionate increases in profits. And then you also get a re-rating as well, so you get sort of triple whammy. For these to trade at 8.50, having traded at £26, you can't know exactly when it's going to happen, but you do know that people's psyche and perception of it's going to improve, and we've just seen the slight hint of that with the sort of 20 or 30% increase we've seen in the last month or so.
Yeah. No, I think if that destocking is finished now in healthcare and the medical side, then that's 80% gross margins, and that'll make a huge move, you know, shift in the level of profitability, particularly if they get approval to start selling their peak knee in India next year, which is what they're obviously hoping to do. So, high value. Okay, good. We come to the final company. If anybody wants to ask Richard any more questions, please put them into the chat bot and I'll read them out. Let's move to a sort of special situation, Trufin, that I know we've talked about before. It's three divisions, one sort of invoice factoring, early payments, and then the last one is obviously gaming, which I think is now doing really well off the back of a bit of a blockbuster mobile game, Balatro, I think it is. How are you seeing this one? The shares likewise have done pretty well.
I mean, you've basically got three businesses. One is a sort of steady grower and cash generative in Oxygen. I think they had a bit of about mid to high 20s for that.
Yeah,
I think that was turned down. That business probably worth 35 to 40 million.
Yeah,
the Satago software business lost a Lloyd's contract. Large companies, particularly large financial companies, do things like that. The technology is good behind it. They need to find a couple of other people. I kind of value that about 10 million.
Yeah.
You're probably paying 20 to 30 million for the games company. But the key here, I think, is that the more run-of-the-mill games, rather than this Balatro product that you mentioned, they are making 100 to 150% return on. So there is an engine here which is not dependent on huge successes. Having said that, the Balatro product has won a number of awards recently, and I think that just basically means the cash and the sales will continue nicely into 2025. Otherwise, you'd have to say that it's going to be difficult to repeat that. But also, it's not an episodic game where you have to go out and spend a year and a half producing lots more stuff. They can produce more of the elements of it quite quickly, and I think the developer is talking about how they develop it. And it's quite rare for a UK games company to have a product that's won three of the categories of the Game of the Year, which is like the Oscars. So although it's difficult to repeat that, I think the games business is worth more than 25 to 30. I also think the management I've said that in 2 to 3 years, you know, this won't be three divisions.
Yeah.
So there are quite a lot of sort of some of the parts, sort of investment funds and things like IP Group, Molten Ventures, you know, we're straight at 50% discount to NAV. But I think because this is going to be broken up, I think we don't necessarily require a discount to it.
Yeah.
I think they've got 8 to 10 game launches next year. I think they're very excited about some of them. If you dig around on PlayStack, which is their games division, you find, I think there's games called Dark Water and Unbeatable that may be good. But when you know, it's the run-of-the-mill steady games that are doing 100 to 150%.
Yeah.
Which probably means that the value of the games business is way more than 25 or 30 million.
Yeah. Well, I mean, it shows confidence from the management team that they can walk away from a £26 million acquisition of Oxygen about 18 months ago, doesn't it? I mean, they're pretty sure about the upside. So that says everything, really.
Well, we've seen one of the non-exec directors put £30,000 or £40,000 in, you know, a bit above today's price. So that's quite recent.
Brilliant. Okay, good. Now, last big question here, Richard. Looking in through your crystal ball then for 2025, which one are sort of the ones we've discussed or any others are the sort of like most excited about for next year?
Well, I think we have, there's been really good progress with the Zegona business. And I think quite a lot of the analysts are painting scenarios for that where from today's sort of £3.10 or whatever they are, you get between £9 and £15 potentially for that. Wow. It's a little bit binary, but I think that probably, I think the progress has been better than the share price implies, albeit the shares have done very well.
Yeah.
And then in terms of if we do get a recovery next year, which I think we possibly could, it's probably the most hated and despised companies that nobody will touch this year that will give you the biggest gains. So I'm talking the likes of, I mean, pick any one of Ondine, Renalytics, Aptima Group, Seeing Machines. It used to be those loss-making companies that are reasonably well-funded. You know, people's behavior is very much to go large cap, go cash-flowing businesses very sensibly. But when you get the recovery, sort of the rules change a bit. You still wouldn't want to be taken on debt or any company that's going to run out of money, because every time they come for it, you know, we're very pleased to give these companies money, but a huge discounts to share prices.
Well, Zegona is definitely a liquid one that anybody wants to get into very easily, but you're right, any of the small cap, if you want to chuck in a you know, reasonable side of money, you're either waiting for a placing or for a share overhang to pick up volume, which means you need to position yourself ahead of that if you do see a bigger recovery, don't you, in these not nano caps, but small caps.
Yeah, you're right. I mean, it's definitely a long-term buy. It could go lower. If you want to buy 5 or 10% of that company, you probably have to buy it now. Now,
yes.
I'm guessing we don't need to buy 5 or 10% of it, and I'm guessing most of your viewers don't either. But, you know, just that tactical versus long-term value. When that companies are, was a similar level in 2008, 2009, we bought them, and I think we saw them fall 30% before they went up 7 or 8 and ultimately 15 times from where we bought them. Yeah. So it's just quite difficult to pick the exact bottom. But in the small cap cycle, we've had three and a half of the worst years. Normally it goes for 2 years. There's a lot of incredibly cheap shares. And we just have to remember that when the stock market offers you things at the wrong price, you do have to buy them at some point.
Yeah.
And you will do very well.
Yeah, no, I'm with you. I mean, it's amazing, isn't it, really? Because AIM, I think, is now sort of retraced all of its gains for this year. It's about -5 or 6% year to date. And even though, you know, everybody really despairs on the actual total, you know, on the prices, actually looking forward for next year, I'm more bullish than I've probably been for 2 or 3 years, simply because, as you say, the value gap and the upside, if you get the right stocks, are going to be potentially very large.
Yeah, and people always at this point ask the UK what's going to move it. I think We don't need money to come into UK equities, although there are some signs of global funds buying UK equities, believe it or not. We just need, we've got an awful lot of buybacks, which give money back to fund managers. We've seen lots of takeovers, and that was really positive in sort of certainly around about May and July of this year. In fact, it did look really positive just post-election prior to the budget. Bit of a home goal and messaging around that. But quite reassuring, actually, in November, there were quite, for the first time in 41 months, there was some money coming into UK equities. As I say, we don't necessarily need that because the buybacks and the takeovers are more than paying for any redemptions. But it's difficult because I, at some sense, people that buy funds are looking at America and just going, I want to buy into the Mag 7 on 26 times, Costco on 50 times, Walmart on 35. And you poor old UK stocks are sitting there on 10 and a half. Mm-hmm. And you either, at some point, we will get value and momentum in the UK. And I think most people in small cap would say that that usually tends to happen when interest rates start to go down, which we have seen. They're certainly not going up, going down, albeit slowly. That should be the start of the small cap cycle.
Yeah, no, I would agree. I think I've been calling it for a long time, but I'm with you. I'm positive heading into Christmas, and it's a good way to finish. So thanks very much, Richard, for all your comments. And I would like to say again to the questions, thanks for the audience, and a big thanks, obviously, to Edison for sponsoring the show and keeping the lights on. So thanks again, Richard. Best of luck with all the investments. Really, great insights for everybody to have a good look through over the festive period.
Thank you very much, and happy Christmas, everybody.
The Vox Markets Podcast. Nothing in this podcast is intended as investment advice, and the people in this podcast may hold positions in the stocks they talk about. Do not buy anything based solely on a tip or recommendation. Please do your own research.
Step into modern luxury at Langham in Grandview. Your boutique, studio plus suite awaits with a premium kitchen, spa-inspired bathroom, and elevated finishes throughout. Just steps from your door, lounge poolside in a private cabana, unwind in the hydrotherapy spa, perfect your swing with virtual golf simulators, or visit the fitness center for a Peloton ride. Availability at Langham is limited. Reserve your studio plus suite today at livepreferred.com.
Leagues Cup returns to Columbus. Your reigning Leagues Cup champion Columbus Crew are hosting three matches at Lower.com Field. Come out and watch the crew take on teams from Liga MX, Toluca, Puebla, and Leon starting July 29th. Grab your tickets now at ColumbusCrew.com and watch the best in North America battle to keep the trophy at home in Columbus. No ties, only wins. Major League Soccer versus Liga MX. Leagues Cup returns to Columbus, Ohio. Be there.